You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight we're going to hear from two amazing authors whose current books are significant contributions to the literature of the gay rights movement. Their work offers a profound appreciation of LGBT forebears and the stories behind the people who created a new civil rights movement. We're going to have time for you to ask some questions as well after our conversation, so get ready with your questions, and we ask that you do make it a question. We do record for podcast, so we'll be circulating microphones, and we will bring the microphone to you. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can, and our authors will be signing afterwards in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. Historian Lillian Faderman's new book, The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle, takes on the years of outrageous injustice, the early battles, the defeats, leading up to the subject of Roberta Kaplan's book, Then Comes Marriage, the stirring account of the United States versus Windsor and the defeat of DOMA. Faderman's book, which is both epic and remarkably intimate, charts the evolution of the struggle for gay equality from the days she writes, quote, when a much-loved and gifted professor could be disgraced, thrown into jail, and hounded out of his profession as soon as his private life was revealed, to the days when a military officer could marry the woman she loves in broad daylight and be promoted in a very public ceremony to the rank of general with her wife by her side. This is a book that overflows with riveting stories, human peculiarities, and thoughtful analysis. To read Faderman, writes the New York Times, quote, is like viewing the AIDS quilt, which overwhelms the viewer with a care taken in each of its numberless panels. Attorney Roberta Kaplan hones in on a specific story, her defeat of the Defense of Marriage Act before the Supreme Court. We learn about her strategy in the lower courts, her preparation for her dramatic oral argument before the Supreme Court justices. We also learn about her own difficult coming out journey, how she created her own family, and in one of my personal favorite sections of the book, why she watched SpongePants Bob with her wife and son in a hotel room in D.C. the night before her oral presentation before the Supreme Court. Lillian Faderman is an internationally revered scholar of lesbian and ethnic history and literature. Among her many honors, she is the recipient of 6 Lambda Literary Awards. She's the author of Surpassing the Love of Men, Odd Girls, and Twilight Lovers, which were both all New York Times notable books. Roberta Kaplan is a litigation partner at the firm Paul, Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. Since winning the landmark Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Windsor, she has won a case on behalf of gay couples seeking to marry in the state of Mississippi. And our interlocutor tonight, whom we are always delighted to welcome back to the stage of Aloud, is Pat Morrison, who is a writer and columnist for the Los Angeles Times and has hosted the daily Pat Morrison Public Affairs program on KPCC. Pat has won 6 Emmys and 10 Golden Mike Awards for Life and Times Tonight on KCT and for her KPCC show, which won 3 Golden Mike Awards for Best Public Affairs in its 6-month run. We're just so happy to welcome her back. Please welcome all 3 of our distinguished guests, Lillian Faderman, Roberta Kaplan, and Pat Morrison. Thank you.
Thank you for coming tonight. I was a little surprised to come in and see that there weren't boxes of Kleenex here and there, because you're going to be crying in frustration but crying in joy as you hear some of the remarkable things that have come out of these 2 particular books. So thank you for being here, and thank you too for being here. From the time that black slaves were brought to North America till the time that black men had full legal standing in this country, although the practicality of that is still being fought, was maybe 250 years. From the time of the Seneca Falls Convention for Women's Rights until the amendment that gave women the right to vote nationally was about 75 years. And yet we're talking about a cycle that's getting tighter and tighter with gay rights. So maybe as the wheels of justice still grind exceeding fine, maybe they aren't grinding quite so slowly. So we're going to hear from our two guests about their particular stories, the broad perspective that Ms. Faderman brings, and the individual case story from Roberta Kaplan about DOMA, the United States versus Windsor and the defeat of DOMA. Ladies, again, thanks for being
here. Thank you.
Thank you.
So maybe given what I just said, Ms. Faderman, you can talk about the comparative speed with which gay rights, gay standing has been acknowledged in this country legally, socially, in almost lightning speed compared to some of the other social movements.
I think that it seems like lightning speed to many, but it has not been.
And to historians.
The movement became a movement actually right here in Los Angeles in 1950 when Harry Hay, for the first time ever, identified homosexuals as an oppressed cultural minority. And he founded the first ongoing homophile organization. I should say, incidentally, that to the outside world, we were all homosexuals, whether we were lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender or queer. And among ourselves, we were all gay. The other words were not operative at that time. Harry Hay's movement lasted for several decades. In San Francisco, again in California, in 1955, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon helped found a group called the Daughters of Bilitis. And so the struggle has been going on since then. It's not, as Vice President Joe Biden said on Meet the Press several years ago, that it was Will and Grace that helped change American attitudes. It was the struggle of activists since 1950 that helped change American.
Maybe the original title was Will and or Grace, and that moved it forward. And you were in the thick of this in a case that many cases were struggling toward the Supreme Court that had to do with gay rights, with same-sex marriage, but it was your case that got it there. And the strategy was in not looking at it as a same-sex marriage case. It was a tax case in fairness, pure and simple.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, Lillian's, of course, right that this struggle has been going on a long time. But she lives in the world of history, and I live in the world of lawyers. It's a very different world. And in legal terms, if you look at the four cases that have led to what we have today, which is equality under the law for gay people in this country, there were four cases all by Justice Kennedy.
A Californian
from Sacramento. Romer, Lawrence, Windsor, and Obergefell from last summer. And the Romer case is from 1996.
That was the Colorado initiative that essentially denied rights.
So in legal terms, that is lightning speed. That really is, I mean, the law tends to grind pretty slowly, generally speaking. And in terms of a legal movement and a kind of a legal evolution under the Constitution, that is very, very, very fast. And I think what changed it and it really kind of picked up speed at the end. And I think what really caused the acceleration at the end was essentially the same thinking that we had in the Windsor case, was this was a battle that had to be fought not only in courtrooms, not only to persuade justices, not only to persuade judges, but to persuade our friends and our neighbors and the American people how to see gay people. The arguments, actually, legal arguments haven't changed. The same arguments that we're making in the early marriage cases in 2003, 2004, are the same cases that were made, same arguments that were made last summer. You could look at the two briefs and you wouldn't see a difference. The legal principles haven't changed. Certainly the language of the Constitution hasn't changed. What's changed is the ability of people to hear those arguments. And I believe that's because of the ability of people to see gay people and realize who we are. And that's why it was so important in my case, in our case, to focus on one particular woman and her late spouse, Thea, and Edie Windsor, of course, and the lives they lived.
And Ms. Faderman, the visibility comes very much to the fore, how people kept themselves invisible as well as operating within a system that was determined to keep them invisible, that diagnosed them as clinically depraved.
Yes, I think that most Americans thought that homosexuals were those people lurking in the shadows. They didn't understand that gay people were their brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and sons and daughters. Harvey Milk was so right in 1977 when he said, come out wherever you are. And that has made all the difference. Through the decades, we started to come out, and more of us did come out. In 1993, there was a poll taken of Americans. The question was, do you have a close friend or a family member who is homosexual? Only 22% said yes. In 2011, a similar poll was taken, and three times that number said yes.
So, what happened in those years to change that?
Well, I think it was partly the organization's insistence that we do come out. I think it was indeed partly the media, but it didn't start with Will and Grace. There was a long history before Will and Grace. There was an organization that was called the National Gay Task Force. It's now the National Gay, Lesbian, Transgender, Bisexual, Queer Task Force.
Get that on a bumper sticker.
But in 1974, the National Gay Task Force started a media committee. And they met with NBC because there was a program called Marcus Welby, MD. And one of the shows on the program had to do with a junior high school teacher who molested his male student. And the National Gay Task Force Media Committee said, you're constantly presenting us in these negative terms. We're asking you to stop it. NBC listened. The other networks listened. Suddenly, the networks were presenting gays and lesbians in more positive terms. And I think that made a huge difference. Of course, Will and Grace was preceded by Ellen and the famous Kiss the year before Will and Grace started in 1998. And young people grew up with those much improved images of us on television. So it wasn't simply Will and Grace, but it did have to do with the fact that the media became so much more sympathetic to us.
There's a famous story about the Lawrence case. So when you were in the Supreme Court, when you walk in before the justices come out, there's a huge red velvet curtain. And the curtain's closed. And when they call the cases and the marshal makes an announcement, the kind of the red curtain, it's very dramatic, opens. And the justices walk and
wow,
they sit
like
at the bench.
Old cinema.
Yeah, it's major drama. And so in the Lawrence argument in 2003, it is reported that the bar section of the Supreme Court courtroom was pretty much entirely full of gay former Supreme Court law clerks. You have to be a member of the Supreme Court bar, which actually is very hard, but it just so happens that day that pretty much everyone sitting kind of like in the first five rows here were gay Supreme Court law clerks. And it's reported, I wasn't there, but Pam Carlin, who was and who I would trust with anything, says that when the justice came out, in particular when Justice O'Connor came out, you could see her kind of look, and she started to be like, oh, my God, he's gay? Oh, my God, she's a lesbian? Oh, my God, she's gay. You could literally see, like, these light bulbs kind of flashing. And that's what changed things. There's just no question. I mean, Justice Scalia now says that he's sure he has friends who are gay. I'm sure he does, too. you know, the numbers, when they took the poll and it was 22%, it was actually much more than 22%, obviously. But the problem is people need to come out and say that.
You begin your book, at the beginning you talk about walking into the apartment of your plaintiff and her late wife, as it was, and having a strong sense of déjà vu for a very good reason. Tell us that story.
So I got a call from Edie Windsor in 2009 asking, actually from a friend of hers, saying, would I call this woman named Edie Windsor? She was looking for a lawyer. And when I heard the name, I knew exactly who she was, but I had never met her. And the reason that, and it's not like Edie was a celebrity then, that's not why I knew who she was, but the reason I knew who she was is 18 years before, was my third year of law school. And I was, I would say, even in the times, which were very different, a late bloomer in terms of coming out. I thought about it in high school. I certainly thought about it in college. I certainly thought about it in law school. And I waited to the bitter end of my third year of law school to kind of have the courage to do anything. And it just so happens, this was my bad luck, my parents were coming to visit, and it was Gay Pride weekend. And I had a one-bedroom, a one-room studio on the Upper West Side, and my parents kind of came to visit me, and they had to wend their way through the Gay Pride parade. And by the time they got to my apartment, they were in quite a state.
But your parents were pretty broad-minded about a lot of social issues.
Yeah, my parents were. My mom was a big feminist, and they were very broad-minded. But I had been, one of the reasons I hadn't come out is I was very worried about how they would react. And they started to talk in my apartment about the Gay Pride parade and saying they didn't know what anyone was proud about, and you know what was going on. And my college roommate's mom, Ruth Messinger, who was then the Manhattan Borough president, was in the parade. And my mom said she can't understand what's Ruth Messinger doing marching in the parade, yada yada yada. And I said to my mom, "Please stop, enough." And she, as mothers and daughters often do, she persisted.
No.
And then she said to me, "Why are you saying this? Are you gay?" And I said, "Yes." And she walked over. It wasn't very far because it was a teeny apartment. She walked over to the wall and started banging her head against the wall.
Not in the good head-banging music sense.
But look, it's just not a criticism on my mom. I mean, it really isn't. My mom has apologized for that 10 million times. She's couldn't be any prouder of me and our family and my son. So that's not the issue. Like so many other people, my mom evolved. But I was very low, as you can imagine. It was like all my worst fears had come to fruition. And so I went around asking, I said I needed a psychologist who was good at gay issues. That's the way you talked about it, at least the way I talked about it then, gay issues. And the name I was given was a woman by the name of Thea Speier, from a bunch of people, by the way. And so I went to see Thea as a patient. She was already paralyzed, so she saw patients in their living room.
This was MS.
Multiple sclerosis, twice. I was moving to Boston to clerk, so it was only twice. And here's the most incredible part of it all, is that during those sessions, she talked about Thea. Now, I'm not either a historian or a psychologist, but it's my understanding that it's odd for psychologists, uncommon, to talk about their own lives. But I think Thea, looking back on it, probably thought that I was so despondent, I was so cynical about the prospect of ever having my own love, my own family, my own the life that I wanted, that she probably was convinced that the only way she would ever persuade me is to tell me about her own life. So she talked about Edie Windsor. I remember her saying that she had this brilliant person she'd been with for many years, that she was a brilliant mathematician, that she'd studied at NYU, et cetera, et cetera. And that was it. I never saw Thea again. I would see her during the Gay Pride parades. I would always look, and she would always be sitting in her wheelchair outside her building, which is on Lower Fifth Avenue, but I never approached her. Flash forward 20 years, and I get this call, and I said to Edie, "I'll come to your apartment." I knew exactly where I was going. And when I walked in, this is what I didn't expect. Even though I knew everything, all those feelings came right back to me. And I saw the living room, and I saw where Thea had sat, and I saw where I sat, and I said to Edie, "You got to give me a minute. You know, I've been here before." And I told her the story. But I remember thinking, you know, I am a religious person. You don't have to be religious to think this way. But I remember thinking that God gave me this as a gift to pay Thea back. And I'm going to pay her back for helping me, and we're going to do this.
Told you needed Kleenex, huh? The great difference that 60 years have made in this, when there was a gay McCarthyism going on in parallel to the political McCarthyism, when people were considered diagnostically ill, there are so many small things that incrementally tip the point. Using the word gay, for example, the PFLAG organizations, even AIDS, where you saw people suffering as people, not as gay people. How do you accumulate those forces that reach that tipping point?
When I came out in 1956 as a teenager with a phony ID, I went to a lesbian bar, a gay girls bar, as it was called, on 8th in Vermont, the Open Door. I learned very quickly that all homosexuals were criminals and crazies and subversives and sinners. And I think what the movement has been about is an attempt to tackle one after another of those portrayals of us. And so, for example, in 1973, after years of gay activists fighting with the American Psychiatric Association and getting a foothold, being able to present on panels to talk about homosexuality as a healthy lifestyle, finally, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association declassified homosexuality. We were cured overnight. We were
miracle.
A miracle. We were taken out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That was one huge landmark in our progress. Another, and there's a real irony in that, the AIDS epidemic was the worst tragedy to ever hit the gay and lesbian community. But what it meant is that more people came out. Some people came out involuntarily through the illness, of course. Many people came out because they realized that in the face of such a tragedy, this was no time for closets. Lesbians and gays seemed to mend the conflict that they had had all through the 1970s with lesbian separatism and lesbian feminism, and many lesbians became very active in helping people with AIDS and in fighting for federal funding for a cure. And I think that the AIDS epidemic, as terrible as it was, made us realize that we could fight, that we could take on the federal government and win. So the federal government finally put more money into searching for a cure, and protease inhibitors were finally developed in the 1990s. We've had all of these tremendous challenges, and I think with each one, we realize that either we hang together or we hang separately, and we have learned to hang together. I think that the LGBT community has really been sort of like what Booker T. Washington described as the fingers of a hand. In so many ways, we've been separate. We have so many different gay and lesbian and transgender cultures, and yet when the huge problems have come up, I think we have learned that we have to fight together, and we've learned well how to do that.
Well, let me ask you about that, because when the film Stonewall came out, there was a petition online to boycott the film, because it wasn't perfect to everyone's way of thinking. Any movement knows that the internal fractures can be just as dangerous as the opposition from outside. When you've got PR-minded people who are organizing a pride parade who say, you know, okay, you nipple-pierced people, can you please not be at the front where the TV cameras are? So how did the gay struggle deal with those internal issues and when it came to presenting a united front for policy purposes?
Yes. Barney Frank, who, of course, has been a huge champion of gays and lesbians and ultimately transgender people as well, was determined to get the Employment Non-Discrimination Act through Congress, and he talked to many of his colleagues, and they said that they could certainly vote for an Employment Non-Discrimination Act that included sexual orientation, but not one that included gender identification. And he presented such an act, and it did pass the House of Representatives, didn't get through the Senate. But most of the major organizations got together. The only exception at that time, and they've come around too, was HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. Most of the major organizations got together, started an organization called the United ENDA Coalition, and said it has to be one for all. We are an all for one. We are not going to accept an ENDA that excludes transgender people. And I think it really educated Barney Frank, who helped educate the transgender community that they had to go out and lobby more, they had to talk to Congress people and present their stories. And I think that that's one example of how we learned to work together.
And on that point, I had not known your name, but when I saw this case come down, I thought, you were so clever because you defined it perfectly. And there's a line in the book, we had a little joke in the office. What do conservative right-wingers dislike even more than gay marriage? Taxes. This was a straight-up tax case about a couple. When one partner died, the other one got screwed because of estate taxes because they were not allowed to marry. So you not only had two women who were the ideal couple, they were the ideal plaintiffs.
Yeah, I mean, Justice Ginsburg has called Edie the perfect plaintiff. And I have to say, I agree with that. I mean, you're exactly right. It not only is their lives together, the 40 years, truly in sickness and in health, till death did they part. Also, Edie, many of the things that you heard Lillian talk about in terms of prejudice in the McCarthy period, Edie herself actually experienced in her life, which we brought out to the court. But on top of that, I'm going to quote you on this, she really was screwed in having to pay a huge bill solely for being gay. That's what it was. If she'd been married to if she'd been married to a guy by the name of Theo rather than Thea, the tax bill would have been zero. And I thought that any American would get that. You know, we don't like taxes here in this country very much. We certainly get what it means to pay an unfair tax. I've been watching with my 9-year-old Liberty Kids, which is an old PBS series about American history, and a lot of the episodes are about Call Me Crazy and unjust tax, which started this country. And so it's part of our culture. So I really thought that people would get that. I was not concerned that people would think, you know, Edie was some privileged white lady. Most of the tax was basically because they bought an apartment in Manhattan in 1980, and like anything in Manhattan, it increased in value exponentially. But I thought it was the best way to present the injustice of this inequality, not only to the American people, but ultimately to the justices. And ultimately, in a case like this, your audience are 9 people sitting, standing behind that velvet robe and then sitting at the bench.
But it was also a case where here's a woman who is an older woman, so she's not like sexually threatening in a way. She looks like, you know, the moms at the country club.
Yeah.
And so there were so many factors because she was a widow and all of these other things that made her very sympathetic, which goes to picking and choosing of the kind of things that we were just talking a minute ago. You talk about a Matthew Shepard. You talk about AIDS patients. You talk about Harvey Milk. And even though they may not be just like everybody else in the movement, they have a significance that makes them unassailable politically.
Well, I have to be honest about the sex thing. So we had an early conference in the case. I can't, at this point, I can tell the truth. We had an early conference, press conference in the case, and some young person, totally understandably, said to Edie, you know, what's the secret? What was the secret of your relationship? You guys were together 40 years. What was your secret? And Edie's answer was, keep it hot. And then she proceeded to kind of go into detail, which I'm not going to repeat.
Although you did say when they met, they made out in a car in the East Hamptons all afternoon, right after they...
That's about as... And even that's in the after we won the case. So after she did that, I pulled her aside and I said, look, you know, I really don't want Justice Scalia reading or imagining or knowing
a heart attack
about your sex life. You know, okay. I don't, you have to do a deal. We'll make a deal. You cannot talk about your sex life until we've won the case. Once we've won the case, all bets are off. You can say whatever you want. I don't care. But you cannot talk about during the case. And she agreed. She totally complied with the deal. But the minute the case was over, if you want, feel free to watch. Judy Gold did an interview with Edie at the 92nd Street Y, and feel free to watch it. But there's plenty about her sex life in it. But that was one of the rules, because you do have to think about who your audience is and what you're making the story to. And it was important for me for the court to see this as a kind of a principle about unfair taxation, and not to be thinking about, you know, the rest.
Now, as far as other matters that were, they weren't extra legal, but they broke in your way. For example, in the Prop 8 case in California, one thing that happened is that the state of California decided not to defend Prop 8 in court. And so the Prop 8 supporters had to shop around for somebody to carry their case who had legal standing. They ended up with some clerk, I think, in the Inland Empire. And we all know how that turned out. But in the same thing kind of happened with your case when the federal government said, you know, we're not going to defend DOMA anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that of all the things that happened in the case, I mean, let me back up. I thought we were going to win in the trial courts. I'm a New York lawyer. I know the trial judges in New York. I thought we'd win in the Second Circuit. I knew that a DOMA case would get to the Supreme Court. I had no idea at the beginning that would be ours. It's really almost random at that point. But the one thing in the case that really surprised me was when the government changed positions. The story about it is we're doing the case. Edie was not in good health. She had had a heart attack after Thea died, and she had two pretty serious heart episodes during the case itself where she was hospitalized. And so I was very anxious to make sure that not only was she alive when we won the case, but that she could enjoy her victory. That was my goal. And so I wanted to do everything I could to push the case forward. So we filed the case. The government gets 60 days to respond. And I got a call about 45 days in from the trial attorney at the DOJ saying, we'd like an extension. And I said, forget about it. You know, I'm a plaintiff. I don't get to be a plaintiff all that much. Edie's not in good health. You know, we're moving this case forward. Go jump in a lake, I basically said. Then I got a call a few minutes later from kind of the mid-level Department of Justice attorney. And he said, Robbie, I'm asking for an extension. We want to decide what to do in the case. Can we have an extension? I said, forget about it. Then I got a call 15 minutes later from the guy who was then the third in command at the Department of Justice, Tony West, Kamala's brother-in-law.
Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris's brother-in-law, Maya Harris's husband. And he said, Robbie, he said, what's this I hear that you have already told two lawyers you're not giving an extension? I said, that's right, Tony, that's what I said. And he said, are you serious? He said, I'm telling you that the president and the attorney general and I need to talk about how to respond to this case, and we need time to do that. And are you telling me that you're not giving me an extension? Even then, talk about chutzpah, I said, hold on, let me think about it. So I hung up the phone. I went to a very good friend of mine whose office next door. I told him the story. He said, what, are you crazy? He's like, of course you're going to give them an extension. I went back. I gave him the extension. But even then, I just believed they wanted a delay. I have to tell you, I was so cynical. I thought, I didn't really believe them. And so I said,
you said, okay. You thought they were playing for time.
Playing for time. And lawyers sometimes do that, I have to admit. So I said to him on the phone, okay, Tony. I said, I just want you to know. And I didn't even believe he was going to be talking to the president. I said, when you and the president and attorney general deliberate on this, I just want you to know I'll be praying for you. And I was probably more sarcastic than that. End of the phone call. 30 days later, I get an email. I'm at spring break. I was on vacation with my family. And it says, Tony West wants to have a phone call. We knew what it was. You don't get emails like that much as an attorney. We knew exactly when it happened. We get on the call, and Tony says, the president and Attorney General Holder and I have gone through the factors for heightened scrutiny. We've decided that gay people should, in fact, get heightened scrutiny under the law. Therefore, DOMA is unconstitutional. Therefore, we won't be defending it. I had tears, literally. I'm not exaggerating. And I'm kind of a tough person, I'll be honest with you, but I had tears streaming down my face. And at the end of the call, Tony says to me, he said, Robbie, I said, you remember that thing you said to me about praying for me and the president? I said, sheepishly, yeah. And he said, well, sometimes prayer works.
Bingo.
But, you know, the coolest thing about that is, first of all, like, we live in this world today, and we can get really cynical about things. And we can assume that everything that happens in Washington is not based on principle or the merits, but for other reasons. This, sometimes, elected officials do things because it's the right thing to do. And even though I am very, very reluctant to make direct comparisons between the African-American civil rights movement and the gay civil rights movement, I think there are similarities, but there are profound differences. I don't think it's a coincidence that it was three black guys who made that call. I really don't. I've said that, I've told that to Attorney General Holder, and he told me I had to stop because he was crying. But I think, you know, they were like, we're not writing a brief that says it's okay to discriminate against gay people.
So let me ask you, Ms. Faderman, about politicians and how their role changed in this. essentially Vice President Biden outed President Obama, who said he pushed the president's hand by saying, well, of course he's in favor of same-sex marriage. And you can go back to John Lindsay, to Ed Koch, and how politicians who put the finger up in the wind know when to change and how to change.
I have a little Obama story. In 2006, I published a book called Gay LA, and my publisher, thank you, my publisher sent me to the Miami International Book Fair. I tell that part only because that's how I happened to be there. Another book had come out shortly before that called The Audacity of Hope by a senator from Illinois. He had just barely gotten to the Senate. He was so extremely charismatic that his reputation had gotten around all over the Miami Book Fair, and he was supposed to speak in an auditorium, and they had to get a much bigger auditorium, and still 2,000 people were turned away. The first question that he was asked was addressed to him by a woman. He had barely come into the Senate, and the woman began her question, Mr. President, and everyone in the audience burst out in huge applause. I happened to be sitting near the mic, and so I got up and I got to ask the second question. And my question was, I said, you've spoken so eloquently about black civil rights. Will you please say something about gay civil rights and same-sex marriage? And his response was so interesting. He said, well, if I were starting the movement, I wouldn't start with gay marriage. Well, of course, that was ignorant. The movement had been around since 1950. But the second part of his response was, when my parents got married in 1961, there were 18 states where they could not have married as an interracial couple, of course. And then he said, so how could I be against gay marriage? And I think that was always Obama's gut feeling. When he was running for president the first time, he actually had an open letter to the gay and lesbian community that was online on gay blogs and in gay publications, saying that he intended to use the presidency as a bully pulpit to get rid of DOMA and that he would fight for gay rights. He was invited to the Alice B. Toklas Democratic Club in San Francisco, and he couldn't attend. This was 2008 as he was running, and couples had started to get married in June 2008. He couldn't attend, but he wrote a letter that he wanted to be read aloud, and the letter congratulated all of the couples who legalized their love through marriage. I think that's where his gut feeling was. But he also appeared on a television program with Rick Warren, who was the minister of Saddleback Church, a church with 23,000 congregants. One of the first questions that Rick Warren asked him was about same-sex marriage. This is when he was running for the presidency. And his response was, and it was so scripted, he said, I believe marriage is between a man and a woman, and as a Christian, I believe it's a sacred union. But he didn't hesitate to add that he believed that same-sex couples should have civil unions. The example he gave of the importance of civil unions was when one partner is in the hospital, the other one should be able to have access to the couple. So very clearly, his sympathies were right, but he was a politician. I think things began to change for him when the polls began to change. When he was running in 1940, only 40% of those polled, the electorate, said that they approved of same-sex marriage. By 2011, 70% said that 70% of young voters between 18 and 25 said they approved of same-sex marriage, and the general population, 53%, said that they approved of same-sex marriage. What he realized running for the second term was that this young demographic was on our side, and it was safe to come out. It was safe to come out in favor of same-sex marriage.
So many of the public figures who opposed equal rights were not very sympathetic. You had Phyllis Schlafly of the Eagle Forum, and as you write extensively in the book, the Anita Bryant orange juice campaign, which did her far more harm than it did to gay people.
It did.
Can you talk about that a little
bit? In 1977, Miami-Dade, which is, of course, supposed to be a liberal county in Florida, added to the existing city ordinance that protected ethnic and racial minorities and women and people with handicaps, added just the words gay people, which meant that there could be no discrimination of gay people in terms of employment, housing, and public accommodations. Anita Bryant, who you all know who Anita Bryant is, I assume, the orange juice lady who was a popular, very popular singer and a fundamentalist. She
and a Miss America, wasn't she?
She was a runner-up in a Miss America.
As in so many other things.
Right, yes. Yeah, she was a resident of Miami, and she was very upset that the city council had voted in a non-discrimination ordinance that included gay people, and so she immediately organized. Actually, I think she was used by the churches as a figurehead, but in her name, an organization called Save Our Children was established, and they campaigned to absolutely turn around the Miami voters. It was clear in the beginning that the Miami voters didn't care if gay people had their rights, that was just fine. But of course, she presented the old boogeymen of gay people as child molesters, and the organization Save Our Children worked with churches, and they had a very concerted campaign. And the ordinance was repealed. She then brought her venom to other cities that had gay rights ordinances, such as St. Paul, Minnesota, and Wichita, Kansas. They repealed their ordinances. Eugene, Oregon repealed its ordinance that gave gay people freedom in terms of non-discrimination in housing and employment and public accommodations. And John Briggs, who was a right-wing senator in California, thought this was a wonderful opportunity to promote his ambitions to become governor of California, and he brought to this state the Briggs Initiative, which would have forbidden any teacher in a public school who was homosexual. They would have automatically had to be fired, but not only that, any employee of the public school who said anything nice about homosexuals or mentioned that a homosexual was a friend or whatever, they too would have to be fired. It really looked as though the Briggs Initiative would pass. Polls said that it was going to pass by a wide margin. This was a wonderful instance, I think, where Northern California and Southern California, it was two places that usually hated each other. They managed to work together. All segments of the LGBT community, the suits and the streets, as they were called, still hostile to each other personally, but they managed to work together, each doing its own job to get the vote out, to get the word out. And finally, the Briggs Initiative was defeated.
There was a massive boycott of
Orange juice,
of orange juice, and there's a wonderful story in your book that Troy Perry, the founder of the Metropolitan Community Church, which by then had scores of congregations across America, was on a plane from L.A. to New York when the stewardess placed glasses of fresh-squeezed orange juice in front of all the business-class passengers. "Take it away," he said. "I can't drink it. I'm a homosexual." The Briggs Amendment was mentioned. We all remember our famous governor, Briggs. Wasn't it Mr. Briggs whose son turned out to be gay and whose...
Pete Knight's son was gay.
That was a different anti-gay measure.
Yeah, that was Proposition 22, which actually then led ultimately to Proposition 8, the marriage proposition.
So we have these efforts in states and cities that kind of laid a groundwork for what it is you did. In Colorado, it was Amendment 2, which statewide, this was the year that Bill Clinton won Colorado, but this measure to deny rights to gay people also was one of the foundational legal cases.
Absolutely.
So there was a mesh, I think, that made your DOMA case possible. Can you talk about a few of those?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, before the victories, there were a lot of losses. You know, Mary Bonato, my friend Mary at GLAAD in Boston, had a very concerted strategy only to start bringing marriage cases in places that she thought she could win, and only in states in which where it was very, very hard to amend the state constitution to kind of exclude gay marriages once there had been a court case. So Vermont was chosen very deliberately initially, then Massachusetts. And those were two amazing victories, but there were a lot of losses after that. One of those was mine. In 2004, I brought a case after Jason West started marrying some people. I mean, after Gavin Newsom started marrying some people in San Francisco, the 22-year-old mayor of New Paltz, New York, decided to do the same. And we brought a case in New York, and we lost it big time. In a decision that was then quoted throughout the country by many, many judges, by a guy who ended up was actually one of my former law partners, saying that it was okay not to give gay people equality under the law because of what we has come to be known as either the responsible procreation argument or what we at the Windsor team like to call the slutty heterosexuals argument.
Responsible procreation?
Responsible procreation or irresponsible procreation or slutty heterosexuals. And I, of course, prefer the latter. But what it means is this idea that, you know, that they had to find something that differentiated gay couples from straight couples, right? And so the only thing that truly does differentiate gay couples from straight couples is that it is true that only a straight couple can the woman accidentally get pregnant. That is true. When we have kids, we actually probably have to plan for it. And because this was the only difference the other side could seize on, this then became the centerpiece of an argument that it was okay to treat gay couples differently and to only give marriage to straight couples because you want the teenage girl who gets pregnant accidentally to marry her boyfriend, and therefore it's okay to give her marriage. The obvious flaw to that, you don't have to have a law degree.
Or a shotgun.
The obvious flaw to that is the idea that that high school girl is going to decide to get married to the father of her child because Edie Windsor can't. Makes no sense. But those were the kind of arguments that not only were made, but that won for many, many years until we ultimately were able to turn the tide.
And Ms. Faderman, you spend a chapter in the book talking about another foundational legal aspect, which is don't ask, don't tell, and the way that gays were treated in the military.
Yeah, I spend some of the early sections of the book talking about the witch hunts that were conducted in the military on homosexuals. Interestingly enough, those witch hunts were conducted only when bodies weren't needed for the military. And so during World War II, for instance, the only time the military would question someone's sexuality is if somebody came to an officer and said, "I'm a homosexual, and homosexuals aren't permitted to serve, and so I want to get out of the military." And of course, the investigation would be to see if this person really was indeed a homosexual. The point was, I think, that they were afraid of slackers who were heterosexual, who pretended to be gay and really weren't. As soon as the war was over, some of the worst witch hunts of gay people began in the military. During the Korean War, that was in abeyance. There were very few discharges of homosexuals during the Korean War. As soon as the Korean War was over, it began again. During the Vietnam War, there were very few discharges of homosexuals. As soon as the Vietnam War was over, it began yet again. I interviewed a number of very brave people, and some I weren't able to interview because they were no longer alive, like Leonard Matlevich, who challenged the military. And it was quite incredible to me to learn that there were a number of cases, like Matlevich's case, and a sergeant by the name of Miriam Ben Shalom, and a lieutenant in the Navy by the name of Vernon Berg, who actually won their cases when they challenged the military's discharge of them. They won in civilian court, and the military was very willing to settle. And so the civilian court ordered that Leonard Matlevich, for instance, be reinstated. The military didn't want to do that, and so instead they gave him what would be the equivalent of $750,000 in today's money. Same thing happened with Vernon Berg. He was ordered reinstated, but the military gave him a financial settlement. So there was always this kind of resistance on the part of the military. When Bill Clinton came in office, he really did intend to do well by us. And he really thought that don't ask, don't tell would be a good compromise. As long as you didn't talk about your private life while you were on base, you were fine. You could live your private life off base. And it worked for a little while, but eventually the witch hunts, even within Don't Ask, Don't Tell, became as bad as the policy had been before Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Before we get to questions, let me ask you...
I got to tell something, because flash forward, so you just heard what Lonely had to say. So I'm on the Windsor case, right? And Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets repealed in large part due to the efforts of another black guy by the name of Jay Johnson, who's now the Secretary of Homeland Security, but then was counsel at the Pentagon, who I've known for many years because we grew up together at the law firm. And so it's now over, and you'll be shocked to know that there were a lot of gay soldiers who were married. You know, people who go into the military tend to be the kind of people who want to get married. And they had a huge population of married gay soldiers. So I'm sitting at my desk one day and I get a call. And the person on the phone says, look, Robbie, I want you to know about something that's going on in the Pentagon that's really, really important for you to know in your case. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, we have a huge number of gay soldiers who are married. And it's already come to pass that some of those soldiers have either been critically injured or killed. And in the military culture, how you notify family that that has happened is a very important thing. It's part of the honor that every soldier should get. It's a very important part of our culture. Because of DOMA, their spouses are not spouses. And so we can't notify the spouse. We have to notify the mother or the sister. And he said, I want you to know this is agonizing the generals at the Pentagon. They find this so upsetting and so offensive, and I want you to know this when you're litigating the case. So we went from the situation that you heard Lillian talk about to the Pentagon brass essentially telling me that when I'm litigating the Windsor case, I should emphasize this fact that DOMA created such injustice to people who are willing to give their lives for our country.
And when the Pentagon wants it.
It happened.
So... over the summer, we had the Obergefell case, I hope I'm pronouncing it right,
yes,
which said that states, you can't pull any tricks. You have to issue same-sex marriage licenses. You have to honor these marriages across the country. So the fear that you cited that somebody would get married in Hawaii and go back to North Dakota, and oh my goodness, the North Dakotans would have to acknowledge this. It's all equal now. But we're 40-plus years after Roe versus Wade, and people are still attacking it, still trying to get it thrown out. Is this settled law now?
Yes, and there's a difference. Let me explain to you the difference. The difference is what we've heard. The difference is that every single American at this point, I don't even care what the poll numbers are, every single American knows someone who's gay. They have a friend, a family member, a neighbor, a colleague.
Or a favorite TV star.
Or a favorite TV star. Or they watch The Ellen Show. And once you know or admire or love or respect someone who's gay, it's impossible to accept the fact that it's okay to treat them differently solely because of who they are. There's no question that we're not going back. You're not seeing... The only people who want to talk about this issue are the Republican presidential candidates. And the minute the primary's over, they're going to stop talking about it, I guarantee you. This issue is settled law now, and I don't think we're going back. Abortion, obviously, is different. People don't come out, and I understand why, about having had abortions. And so
someone who just did got death threats.
Exactly. Americans don't feel the same way about it. But I don't think there's any chance that we're going back. Justice Scalia, as I said before, has a friend who's gay.
Just one?
This is at least one. This is the law of the land, and we don't have a history in our country of going back in terms of equal rights like this and going back. I don't think it's happening. I litigate these cases in the state of Mississippi, and there's not really very much backlash in the state of Mississippi. So
Kim Davis, out of luck?
Kim Davis is the greatest gift that's ever happened to this movie. No, I'm serious. She is. Okay,
at
here's
least
why.
Since Anita Bryant.
Here's why. Three reasons. One, every single judge who's looked at her arguments has said they're ridiculous. They are. Public servants can't pick and choose which parts of the Constitution they
especially
like.
Especially elected ones.
Yeah, forget it. She has no legal arguments. Two, look at the people who support her. Look at the rallies. They're wearing white robes. They have swastikas. You know, it's so clear to Americans how hateful her supporters are. And then, you know, there's the icing on the cake. She lies about a private meeting with the Pope. I'm sorry, but it really doesn't get any better than that. So, you know, there's always going to be Kim Davises. There are people who want their 20 minutes of fame. In today's world, they get more than 20 minutes. So they're going to pop up. It's kind of like whack-a-mole, but we're going to keep whacking them down, and I predict that it's going to continue that way.
So let's have some questions from the audience. We have a couple of people with mics. Yes, by all means. So raise your hands, and we will follow and get to you. Okay, over here. And just because you have a microphone doesn't mean you're, you know, running for president. Unless you're declaring for Joe Biden here and now.
I only ask questions. You've predicted that we're not going back with respect to gay marriage. Do you expect either a national ENDA or the states that don't have them to pass those laws? Because that hasn't been going forward, and you can't actually, you have to do politics to do that. You can't do it, as far as I can think of, by litigation.
Well, actually, the EEOC takes the position today that even in states that don't have state ENDAs, if you fire someone because they're gay, that is gender discrimination. It violates Title VII. That issue needs to get litigated, but that is the official position of the federal government today. Nothing gets through Congress right now. I mean, they can't do anything. So the chances that it's going to get through Congress, I think, are extremely low. At some point, it will. But I think there's a much greater chance of these state laws passing and making some progress, even in states that seem surprising.
And in 1974 and again in 1975, Congresswoman Bella Abzug and Congressman Ed Koch introduced into Congress an Equality Act. They could get no traction then, but there's been discussion more recently of reintroducing the Equality Act, which would take care of ENDA and take care of all the other little ways that may be left where we're still not first-class American citizens. And Hillary Clinton has promised that if she's elected, she will pass an Equality Act.
And then maybe the ERA, too. Who knows? We have a question over here.
Hi, my name is Rick Hoyt McDaniels, and I'm the minister at the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles at 8th and Vermont, and I would love to know where the open door was exactly.
It was on 8th and Vermont, right across the street from an IF Club, another lesbian bar. Wow. That had been around since World War II. I came to the IF Club and the open door in 1956, but still on the IF Club there was a sign that said, these premises are off limits to military personnel. So the military realized that the IF Club was a lesbian bar. They still didn't know it about the open door, though.
Oh, I'd love to have a photo of it up in my lobby somewhere. The question I wanted to ask was just, you've mentioned religion a few times, just sort of passingly. What do you think the religious influence has been on the gay rights movement, both pro and con?
I think that in recent years it's been astonishing how many churches have come around. The Presbyterian Church, or at least the American Presbyterian Church, now supports same-sex marriage, is very strong in terms of gay rights. The Episcopalian Church, at least one part of the Episcopalian Church, has been very supportive of LGBT people and same-sex marriage. Jewish congregations and denominations, Reform Judaism, Reconstruction Judaism.
Conservative Judaism.
Conservative Judaism. Now, Orthodox Judaism is perhaps a lost cause, but all other aspects of Judaism, organized Judaism, have supported same-sex marriage and gay rights. This was a struggle when Troy Perry founded a...
Troy Perry, the guy who said no orange juice on the...
Yes, floor. Right, that guy. This was another Los Angeles first in 1968. He founded the Metropolitan Community Church, which then spread all over the country, and there are Metropolitan Community Churches in many places all over the world. But he did that because he had been a Baptist minister, and he was not welcome, obviously, in the Baptist church, and still would not be welcome in the Baptist church.
Up there?
I hate to disagree with Attorney Kaplan on one thing, but events...
It's okay, I'm used to it. That's what I do for a living.
Events and history and economics don't always have us go forward. So for people of color, women and gays, at different times to our history, we have gone back. And recently, the Supreme Court, in fact, decided that the Voting Rights Act would not be upheld. But my question is that do you favor us doing a class action movement now case on all the people who were murdered and brutalized and carried all kinds of horrors against us, the military who had taken people who were in the military and then did sex... what's the word I'm looking for? But they had all kinds of torture on these people before they put them in Leavenworth, okay? They basically, sexual experimentation.
Okay, so
shock therapy.
You're
so,
asking about a class
action. So there's
action.
A long history of people who've been murdered and assaulted and violated. And so do you favor now a class action suit against the government on behalf of all these victims so that we get adequate centers?
Okay,
we get
got
support?
It.
Yeah, let me be clear. I don't think the Supreme Court is, I don't think there's any chance that even this court, even a more conservative court, would overrule Obergefell, Windsor, Lawrence, or Romer. That's not to say there won't be statutory problems. It's not to be, we don't have a Voting Rights Act, but it's not to be that if there are statutory issues, there won't be issues there. But I do not believe that those cases are in any danger of overruling by the United States Supreme Court. In terms of class actions, I can only take the cases I get. No one's ever consulted with me about bringing a class action. I'd have to look at it. You'd obviously have to look at statute of limitations issues, which I have not looked at, so I'm not really qualified to answer. On the religion question, though, I would like to say that I think this is one area in which I think our movement made a bit of a mistake. I think we allowed, and there are good reasons why, because it was a different world, but I think we allowed the religious arguments to be ceded to the other side. So it looked like if you were religious, you were anti-gay. And there were no religious people on our side. And I come from a religious tradition that says that every human being was created in the image of God. And that means every human being has dignity. And read Justice Kennedy's opinion. That's kind of what he says. So I think we've really fixed that issue recently. It was a huge effort in the Windsor case. But I don't think we should make that mistake again. You don't have to be religious. But it can't be, it isn't true that religious people are only on one side of this issue.
Over here.
Could you just kind of, for those of us who couldn't be in Supreme Court that morning when you argued, but, you know, I read the transcripts, but I was just wondering, can you just describe like the tone, especially with Scalia? Like, could you feel hostility when he was looking at you? And did you feel support from any of the other justices? I just, you know, just kind of, yeah, you just explain it a little.
Take us there.
Sure. So one of the things about the Supreme Court that makes it different is that you don't, your job as an advocate is to kind of help the judges on your side kind of debate the judges on the other side. So actually the two best moments of my argument came up before I even got up. They were during the argument of my adversary, Paul Clement. Justice Ginsburg, otherwise known as Notorious RBG, made this amazing comparison, comparing the marriages of gay people under DOMA, where you were married under state law but unmarried under federal law, as skim milk marriages. When she said it, I actually couldn't hear her, but I heard the audience laughing because it was louder in the back. And I turned to my colleague, Pam Carlin at Stanford, and I said, what did she just say? And Pam said, she said skim milk marriage. And I literally had to hold my arm back because I was like, I want to do this. similarly, Justice Kagan did a cross-examination. You can listen to it online at a website called Oye. She did a cross-examination of Paul Clement that is the single best cross-examination I have ever heard. She devastated him during this cross-examination, and she was making this point that when Congress passed DOMA in 1996, it explicitly said that the reason it was doing so was out of moral disapproval of gay people. And that's kind of a constitutional no-no. So she just did a devastating cross-examination of that. By the time I got up, therefore, a lot of the work had been done for me. I got no questions from the liberal justices. That's a good sign. You don't really want them to be asking you questions. They're going to ask questions if they think they need to help. So they didn't ask many questions. Most of the questioning I got came from the chief, not from Scalia, from the chief justice. Listen to it for yourself. You can judge. There was definitely some back and forth. And there was one point in the argument toward the very end, the chief asked me a question, something like, isn't it true that politicians are falling over themselves to support your side of the case? And if you listen to the tape, you can hear my voice crack when I answer it. And I said to him, no, that's not true. What's changed the world is not politicians, but it's the flip of what they said in 1996. It's not moral disapproval of gay people. It's a moral understanding that gay people are no different. And I remember it was probably the only answer I gave that we hadn't rehearsed 7 dozen times. And I remember thinking when it popped into my head, I think it's the right answer. I'm going to go for it. I can't turn around and ask Pam whether she agrees. I'm just going to go for it. And, you know, it ended up being a pretty good answer. But that was probably the high point of the argument.
Before we go up here, I want to get some questions from the audience over here as well. So let's go right here, and then we'll start moving over.
Hi, thank you. As a tax attorney, I was thrilled and ecstatic that it was a tax case, because that was a really good one to move forward. Okay, my question is, there's still a lot of discriminatory issues going on. We still have religious exemption issues, we have adoption issues, we have work issues. Can you just maybe outline or what you're familiar with as far as what's going on and what the movement is doing right now?
Yeah, look, as far as I'm concerned, what Windsor and Obergefell say, I mean, it's not my personal opinion, it is what they say, is that governments can't discriminate against gay people. So any federal, state, or local government cannot discriminate. We have a ban in Mississippi on gay couples adopting. We've challenged it. We got briefs in today that have 20 different arguments, none of which have to do with the merits. I mean, the Mississippi officials are tying themselves up into pretzels to try to come up with arguments for why gay couples that can't adopt that have nothing to do with the fact that the couples are gay. We're going to win that case. I'm pretty comfortable we're going to win that case. So the government can't discriminate. The big question is private employers and private businesses. There, I think the answer is partially non-legal. One, American business has no appetite, zero appetite, to allow a store manager or a clerk to decide, I'm not giving you an ice cream cone, kid, because you have two moms. That's the last thing in the world they want to happen. And that's why you're seeing a lot of these RFRA bills are getting beaten by business, frankly, not by us, but by business interests, because it's like it would be a public relations disaster for them, and they don't want it to happen. But you are still going to have these kind of one-offs. You're still going to have the Kim Davises. You're going to have the bakery owner, things like that. They're going to say that their religious beliefs somehow prevent them from serving gay people the way they serve everyone else. It's going to have to get litigated. I remember as a kid growing up in Cleveland, my grandparents telling me a story that when they first got married, They went on a trip. My grandfather's a traveling salesman, and they went to the South, and there were hotels that said no Jews allowed. We're past that. I don't think this country wants places that say no gays allowed. I think we'll win it, but it's going to be a combination of litigation and lobbying, which to date has actually been pretty effective.
Over here? All right.
I was just wondering what you thought if Clarence Thomas had any special insight into this in view of his interracial marriage, which was illegal in the state he's living in up until the past
61.
Couple of decades.
Yeah, I mean, he dissented in both Windsor and Obergefell. In Obergefell, he talked a lot about dignity and kind of disagreed with Justice Kennedy's conception of dignity and said that slaves had dignity, which is not something I really understand. I don't think someone who's enslaved has dignity. But his views are very, he's a pretty strong dissenter, so you should read his dissents. They speak for themselves.
Down here.
Hi. Well, I've read both of your books, and they're brilliant. And what impressed me, and I'm going to ask a question, but about your book, Roberta, was that it was such a great love story. I expected a very dry legal explanation, and we had been in the court, and it was just this wonderful love story. And, of course, Lillian, you're a genius again. I was sitting, yes, you can applaud. She is a genius. She's fabulous. I was sitting in the courtroom watching you, Diane, and my wife and I were sitting there, and I was this far away from that woman there when the guy jumped up. I was in the same row and started screaming about gay marriage, whatever he was saying. I don't know. We were so scared. We didn't know. But I have two questions. What did you feel when he jumped up? Did you ever think he could attack? I mean, did you have any fear?
That happened during Obergefell. So Mary argued Obergefell.
Oh, okay.
So
all right.
So I was in the audience watching, but I wasn't during my argument.
Okay. All right. And the other question I have, John, by the way, nice to see you here. I knew it was you asking that question before I even turned around. That's John O'Brien from the Marches on Washington. I have a question about the equality bill. There already is a civil rights bill. Is this equality bill a separate bill for us? Or why aren't we just, like women, trying to get into the civil rights bill?
The Equality Act would have, in one fell swoop, given us all of the rights that we've worked since 1974 to get. It would, I think, probably deal with the adoption issues, for instance. Because we did not get it in 1974, the legislation has been piecemeal. For instance, there was a hate crimes bill that was finally passed in 2009. If the Equality Act had passed in 74 or 75, we wouldn't have had need for the hate crimes bill. I think to just add us to the 1964 Civil Rights Act would not. I'm going to ask the lawyer here. Am I right?
I'm not an expert on this. I know there were intense negotiations between the women's groups, the African-American civil rights groups, and the gay civil rights group about how to do this in a way that give maximum protection to LGBT people, but doesn't in any way jeopardize the protections that women and African-Americans get. And that's what the bill is intended to do. But that's, I'm not an expert on it.
Is it a separate bill, or is it trying to get into that?
I think in certain respects, essentially puts gay people into Title VII and Title IX and various other bills. But I know it was a very complicated and intensely negotiated way in terms of how they did it.
Up here? Okay.
Thank you.
Two more after this one? Okay.
Russell Brown here. I don't think anybody could have foreseen that the number one media family in the entire nation, the Kardashians, would have had the father husband who was the number one male athlete in the entire world becoming transgender. And that was such a surprise sort of out of nowhere. Do you see any other sort of blockbuster surprises, or where do you think we're going to be? I almost sort of asked myself, as a gay person, sort of what's left?
Yeah. I think that the transgender movement had long been the stepchild of the LGBT movement, and I think that organizations are realizing that we need to put energy into the focus on transgender problems. So I for one am happy that Caitlyn Jenner came out as she did and has gotten so much attention. Without a crystal ball, I don't know what's left.
Last question over here.
Hi, I just had a quick question. My husband's active duty Army, and we've seen some great things happen in the military in the last 11 years. However, we were at a kind of marriage-type retreat about 7 months ago prior to deployment, and I asked the question, so now that benefits are eligible for everyone, how are you going to modify these? Because they're very gender segregated. And the response was, we're not doing it. And
they're not doing the sessions, you mean?
Yeah, they're not going to be allowing same-sex couples into the sessions, which was really sad. So I reached out to everywhere I could and asked questions as far as like the National Family Military Association, all of that. And I've been getting a lot of pushback of, it's not something that we're willing to do right now. So my question is, what do I do?
Tell your elected officials, tell your senators, the Obama administration will not tolerate that if it gets to them. They've been very clear, and the Department of Justice has been very clear, that Windsor and Obergefell need to be implemented throughout the federal government without any delay. So I'm surprised to hear that, actually. And I think they will be very surprised to hear that. And I'm pretty confident that they will do something about it as soon as they possibly can.
And you would probably start with the two senators, Boxer and Feinstein. So. Anyway, please thank our guests today.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.